Welcome along to the Body Boys podcast. Today's guest joins us from the United States. In this episode, we revisit how social media affects body image and some of the gaps that there are in our knowledge base. Welcome, Jennifer. Can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Jennifer Harriger, and I am a professor of psychology at Pepperdine University. And I study a number of factors related to body image and disordered eating. And more recently, my research has focused particularly on the role of social media and body image.
Today, we're exploring your article, which is a combination of current knowledge on how social media affects body image and suggestions for future research, interventions, and advocacy. How did you come to write about this?
My colleague, Dr. Kevin Thompson, and I were co-editors of a special issue for the journal Body Image, and the special issue was titled Social Media and Body Image. And we sought review articles from experts in the field. So we reached out to people all over the world asking if they would be willing to contribute to this special issue. Luckily, everyone said yes. And so this article was a culmination of the recommendations from other researchers, as well as our own recommendations for future work. We also wrote the article with Dr. Marika Tiegemann from Australia, and she is also one of the leading experts in the field of social media. So it was actually an honor to write this article with both of those researchers, because I've looked up to them so much during my career.
The recommendations overall fit into four categories. So we have sampling, measurement, intervention, and advocacy. And the article talks about how research has often drawn from samples of young white women, yet it's clear we need to be thinking about young children, women over 30, boys and men, and other underrepresented groups.
We can't generalize the findings from young white women under 30 to other groups of people. And a lot of the studies have been conducted with college women. And so even generalizing findings from women in college, that might not be the same for people who are not in college. So we can't assume experiences are the same for participants in other groups. So, for example, there's been research that suggests that kids even under the age of 10 are already using social media, and children are notorious for not being able to even decipher reality from fantasy or being able to critically evaluate the messages that they're receiving. And so learning more about the role that social media plays in children's lives and how we can protect children is really essential. Women over the age of 30, they may be going through different transitions, having a child or other body changes that occur with aging. And so that's another population that we need to study. Boys and men are also using social media at high rates, and yet they may be affected differently than women are. So, for example, looking at fitspiration content, highly muscularized images might affect boys differently than they affect girls. And then other underrepresented groups are important to study, too, because I've read that the algorithm tends to have some inherent racial bias, for example. And so if people are using social media and they're not seeing content where they're represented, that could also affect them negatively. So we just think that research looking at other groups of people other than young white women is really essential for moving the field forward and just understanding how everyone is affected by social media.
We need to also refine the tools which assess how we understand people's relationship and interaction with social media. Can you describe the recommendations you're suggesting from a research design perspective?
Yeah, so we first recommended more sophisticated measures or models of social media. So many of the early models that have been examined in the literature were originally designed to assess traditional media use. So things like movies, television, magazines, and the way that people engage with traditional media differs from the way that they engage with social media. So traditional media tends to be more passively used. So someone might sit down and watch a television show or a movie, but they're not actively interacting with the media, whereas social media is much more active. So users can post their own content or comment on other content, like content, or even actively search for their own content. And so it's important to recognize that the existing models that have been used to study traditional media might not necessarily align with the way that social media is being used. And then even when people are using social media, they might be engaging with it in different ways. So some people may more passively scroll through their feed and look at content as it comes to them, and others might be actively seeking out content or posting their own content. And then social media platforms have a lot of different features depending on the platform. So Reels, Stories, the For You page on TikTok. And so understanding how all of those different components work and how they may differ in terms of a user's experience is really essential too. And so we recommended that we either modify existing models that have already been postulated to explain the role of media in eating disorders or body image, or to even create new models that take into account all of the unique variables related to social media. We also talked about the importance of using a variety of research methods to understand social media use. So a lot of current studies ask people to reflect on their own use, and usually at one time point. So we recommended doing longitudinal studies where we follow people for a longer period of time so we can understand more of the role of social media in the development of body image or disordered eating. We recommended using ecological momentary assessment where people are asked throughout the day to immediately respond to questions about their social media use and how they might be feeling. And then there are also some newer studies have looked at social media tracking apps where instead of asking participants to self-report about their own social media use, the apps will track the use. And so the data tends to be a little bit more reliable. And so all of those things will enable us to gain a better understanding of the way that people are engaging with social media, as well as the role that social media plays in how people are feeling throughout the day.
The article talks about media literacy, disclaimer labels, and body positivity messaging.
Yeah, those are all really important topics and things that I feel really passionate about. Media literacy is not a new idea. The media literacy programs have been around for a long time and were originally designed to help people challenge some of the messages in traditional media, but they're now being used in social media. I think the current media literacy programs need to be modified to include some of those variables related to social media use that I had talked about earlier. So, for example, educating viewers about algorithms, how algorithms work and how they may lead users to more extreme and less monitored content, and that the goal is to keep the user engaged for a long period of time. Educating people about likes and comments and how that can affect their well-being. Social comparisons that occur on social media. That's not necessarily unique to social media. People compared themselves to images and videos in traditional media for many years. But the unique aspect of social media is that it gives people the opportunity to also compare themselves to their peers. So they might be looking at content that a friend had uploaded that has been highly edited. And so educating young users about the social comparisons and how that can be really detrimental is really essential in media literacy programs. And then also the role of commercialism, because on social media, it's often not clear whether something is an advertisement or just a post designed to provide information. And so helping young users understand the role of commercialism in social media is also really important in media literacy programs. Disclaimer labels are another area that has been heavily researched. There's been some legislation in different parts of the world that have required companies to add a disclaimer label to let viewers know that an image or a video has been digitally altered in some way. And so there's been some research that's examined the effectiveness of this. Does the disclaimer label actually protect people? And what research has found by and large is that it really doesn't seem to make a difference, that whether a disclaimer label is applied to a post or not, it still seems to have the same effects on a viewer. There is one exception, and that is the use of reality check comments. So this is when someone that's different than the content creator goes onto a post and makes a comment that challenges the post. So they may say something like, there's no way that someone actually looks like this, or this image has obviously been digitally altered. And that does seem to be somewhat effective. So Our recommendations are to continue to research the role of reality check comments, and that might be something that could even be added to the media literacy programs to challenge people to make those comments when they see content that has clearly been edited. And then body positivity messaging. This is something that's become very popular. I think there was a TikTok trend recently where people were posting a lot of body positivity videos. And so the body positivity movement was originally designed to challenge the narrow, unrealistic ideals regarding beauty and to give voices to marginalized groups, and also to help people love and accept their bodies despite flaws. And so there's been research looking at whether exposure to body positivity messaging is protective for users. And overall, it has been found to be somewhat protective. There are some controversies about the body positivity movement. Some people say that body positivity is unrealistic for some people. So the idea that you have to love your body regardless of flaws might not be something that everyone can do and could lead to more guilt if they don't love their bodies. There's also been research that has found that sometimes body positivity posts on social media do not necessarily align with the tenets of body positivity. So someone might caption a post, hashtag body positive, but really it's a thin white woman dancing in a bikini. Or sometimes there are contradictory messages in body positivity posts. So the content creator may say something like, love your body, but then they're also promoting a detox tea. So more research needs to be done to really understand the content of body positivity on social media and how we can use that to protect viewers. There's also been some research recently looking at body neutrality instead of body positivity. So body neutrality focuses more on the functionality of one's body and appreciating the body because of what it can do and recognizing that a body is valuable regardless of its appearance. And so that's an area that is just beginning to be researched. And that might be something that also could be potentially protective for people using social media.
What you said a few moments ago, I'll read a small piece from a report. So it's a European report looking at the influence of social media on child development and the development of young people as well. So it says, children encounter issues such as unfair practices, clickbait strategies, and hidden marketing practices that contravene their rights and which are not in their best interests. Research shows that children are often ill-equipped with low levels of awareness of commercial practices and lack the critical skills to disaggregate marketing content in the context of their experience of social media.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. There was, I remember years ago, there was legislation passed, I want to say in Australia, where the television programs were not allowed to advertise content in commercials that included the same characters that were being depicted in the shows that the children were watching during that time. And it was because research had shown that the children couldn't distinguish between the actual programming and the commercial. And so I think that on social media, the lines are even more blurred. And sometimes it's difficult for adults to even recognize whether a post is an advertisement or not. And so to expect children to be able to do this, I think, is really unreasonable. And so we need to protect children from commercialism, clickbait, all of the things that are affecting adults. But I think children just lack the ability to critically evaluate all of these messages or to even distinguish between what is actual content and what is an advertisement.
Sometimes body image isn't taken seriously as a societal concern because it's dismissed as being all about appearance. What points do we need to think about from an advocacy perspective?
I think it's ironic that it's dismissed because we live in such an appearance-obsessed world, and kids are taught from such an early age that their value is based on their appearance. And social media, I think, serves to reinforce and perpetuate those messages. So it's essential to continue our advocacy efforts to protect young children, as well as adults who are affected by these messages as well. In our article, we recommended that researchers and other experts partner with social media companies to help develop policies that might be protective, particularly for young users. And also, helping people see the role that social media can play in their own advocacy efforts. So social media is actually really valuable in terms of giving people the opportunity to use the platform to challenge unrealistic ideals or to critically evaluate messages that they're seeing or to create movements to address inequalities or campaigns to increase positive body image. In my body image and eating disorder seminar that I teach, my students create online social media campaigns to help promote positive body image or challenge unrealistic ideals. And I think it really gives them the opportunity to recognize that they have more power than they thought. And so being able to teach this to young users might be protective in that they can recognize that social media isn't something that they have to just passively consume and that they can play a more active role in their experience.
To come back to the earlier question where we talked about some of the limitations and a lot of focus on young white women, how do you think we changed that in getting more research done on other groups?
Well, I think that possibly having grant funding to research other groups could be one way to increase research in those areas. Sometimes just a call to action. So having journals or other organizations put out a call for more research in a particular area, or having journals publish special issues where they ask researchers to submit work from about particular populations. Those are could all potentially be tools to help increase work in areas where we don't know as much about how social media might affect particular groups.
And the paper has since been cited quite a lot. You have, I think at the moment, 29 citations. So there's been a lot of interest in what you've published.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I think our goal of publishing the paper was just to raise awareness of these issues and to make some recommendations for future work, because the social media world is rapidly evolving and changing, and we can't keep up. And so research that continues to look at, you know, all of these factors as well as new components of social media is really essential.
Turning to the conclusion of the article, so it states, we must remain focused and number in our efforts to identify, inform, and influence the conversation among researchers, clinicians, advocates, and corporations.
Yeah, so this really is just a call to action that this is such an important topic. I've talked with a lot of researchers and parents who say that this is a crisis. And if you look at what's going on in Congress and lawsuits, we see that this is a crisis. And so our hope is just that as researchers, we can play a small role in determining ways that we can protect users and just empower parents and other stakeholders to find ways to protect their children.
Finally, Jennifer, is there anything else you wish to add?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this and to be on the podcast. I'm so passionate about this topic, and so it was great to be able to be here to talk about it with you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That concludes this episode. Thank you very much to Jennifer for joining us today. You can find a reference to Jennifer's research article in the episode notes. Thank you for listening.